So the experiments, we call them tabletop experiments, small-scale experiments, most of them focus on what is called beyond the standard model physics. And first of all, by the standard model, we mean this. This is what several hundreds of years of theoretical and experimental research has brought us to. And this is a model that describes a wide variety of phenomena with only 20 particles and roughly 20 parameters. And it has been very successful. So the range that where we have tested, the range of scales that we have tested the standard model, in many cases spans tens of orders of magnitude. Okay. Here you see the known scales in the universe, from the biggest scale, the universe itself, to the smallest scale, the Planck scale. There's roughly 60 orders of magnitude. The masses of the standard model particles fall in a narrow range, somewhere here. The LHC, the Large Hadron Collider, is pushing this our knowledge of particles in the high energy frontier. And somewhere in the middle, you have the neutrino masses and the scale of the cosmological constant. So this is actually, this axis is also very nice to demonstrate some of the questions. So if we have such a successful theory, if it works so well, why do we need to go beyond it? One of the big puzzles is, first of all, the size of this range. Why is the universe so large? Why is there a 60 order of magnitude hierarchy between the Planck scale and the size of the universe? This is the so-called cosmological constant problem. Another problem that is of the same nature, trying to explain a large hierarchy between numbers, is the so-called hierarchy problem. And in fact, this has been mostly the focus of beyond the standard model physics in particle theory for the past 30 years. The hierarchy problem is the discrepancy between the measured Higgs mass, or the masses of the standard model particles, and the Planck scale. That's one way to see it. Another way to see it is to ask the question, is why gravity is so weak? So every time, for example, you raise an object, the electromagnetic forces in your hand overcome the gravitational pull of the entire planet. You don't think about this all the time because it hurts to go upstairs sometimes. electromagnetic forces are screened. They are not long range. But gravity only becomes important if you have something that's very, very big as a planet. And in fact, this has been much of the driving force for the past 30 years behind the Collider program. The Collider program, so and this led us to the Large Hadron Collider. Of course, the Collider program in particle physics has a very long history. For the past more than 50 years, every time we were building a collider that had a higher and higher energy, we would find something new. We would find a new resonance, a new force. So this is what led us to complete, this is what helped us complete the standard model of particle physics as we know it. But as I showed before, if you look at the totality of the energy scales available for us, you will see that the Collider program is not able to probe that entire parameter space. In fact, 80% of that parameter space is left unexplored. And we know there are things that the Collider cannot see. Many things that the Collider cannot see. Take, for example, and in fact, even in the standard model itself, the greatest example of this is gravitational wave radiation. Gravitational wave radiation requires a very precise probe to detect it because it interacts with us so weakly. There is no way we can detect or even produce gravitational waves at colliders at a detectable rate. There's neutrino masses. Colliders tell us very little about it. There is electric dipole moments. These are experiments that look for tiny fundamental electric dipole moments, even for the electron, either to the neutron. They've been going on for tens of years. And they require, again, they work in the precision frontier. They require very sensitive experiments. And they work at a regime that's complementary, pushing the energy scale even beyond what LHC can see. I won't talk much about EDM experiments, even though, and the motivation behind them, because, not because I don't think that they are important, I think they are extremely important, but they are long, they have long been established. So in the next, so what I would like to do is try to motivate to you new ideas in theoretical physics that can be you, that people can, that you can probe with your experiments in the lab. The other interesting thing is, this shouldn't be here. The other interesting thing is that there is a plethora of new approaches in the precision frontier. While particle physics has been so focusing so much on particle on collider physics, other fields of physics have seen tremendous progress. And I think it's time to put that progress together with that, with theoretical understanding, to see what we can do with it, what we can learn about the world. And in order to motivate this, I could have picked several approaches. And in fact, depending on who, which theorists gives this talk, they would present it from another angle. But I want to believe that the end product of what they would present, it would be motivating similar similar phenomena, similar particles, similar forces for you guys to look for. So my unifying theme for the rest of the talk will be dark matter. Okay? This is, even though, as I said, the standard model has been very successful, but in fact, it only describes this little sliver of the energy budget of the universe. 95% of the energy budget of the universe, we really, in reality, we don't know where it's coming from, and we've only seen it through the force of gravity. 75% of it, roughly, is what we call dark energy, which is a big puzzle because, or what we call the cosmological constant. It is a big puzzle because we were expecting it not to, to be even a more dominant part of the energy density of the universe. Okay? We're expecting it to be much, much bigger than what it is. In fact, if the cosmological constant had its natural value, the universe will be literally at most this big, millimeter in size. Okay? So this is a big puzzle that the best idea that we have for it is the landscape and anthropics, and not many people like it. For the rest, and now I will talk about, though, for this other 25%. And in fact, the motivation that I will give about the origin of this 25%, the dark matter, is closely connected to what, to the landscape and dark energy. So dark matter, it's matter that only interacts with us with gravity, it doesn't interact with light. We've known it's been there for a long, long time. There is a lot of evidence of its existence at different scales, different energies. So the question you ask, so when you go to your theorist friend and you ask, okay, what is dark matter? And for every theorist, you get a different answer because everyone has roughly a different favorite model. If you want to be more quantitative about how big the range of dark matter models is, if you were to put it in an energy scale, you would find that it would cover the possibilities for dark matter will cover 90 orders of magnitude in energy scale. If you were to make dark matter to be a very light particle, at some point, when the particle becomes lighter than 10 to the minus 22 eV, the particle's Compton wavelength becomes so large that it doesn't fit inside galaxies. So you cannot produce the structure that we observe. This is what some people you may have heard, or fuzzy dark matter, or Bose-Einstein condensate dark matter. All these fall in this category, even though there is no Bose-Einstein condensate. But they go by the name of fuzzy dark matter models on this side. Now, if you make the dark matter very heavy, go past the Planck scale, now you no longer talk about elementary particles, but you talk about composite objects. Then you hit the wall at around 10 to the 70 eV, which is around 10 to the 3, 10 to the 4 solar masses. At that point, the dark matter becomes too granular for us to observe the structure that we see, how fuzzy the dark matter is distributed around galaxies. Okay? And this 90 orders of magnitude is all populated, as I said, with tons of dark matter models, of tons of dark matter candidates. Now, the next question you ask is, how is it produced? And this is where most dark matter candidates fail. Okay? Take, for example, primordial black holes. For primordial black holes, as dark matter candidates, there are not that many good production mechanisms that wouldn't be already excluded by observation. The answer, the affirmative answer to this question is what made the weakly interactive massive particles very popular. If you had a particle in the early universe that interacted with us with the strength of the weak interaction, the strength of that the W and the Z boson interact with us, and if it was in thermal equilibrium, due to its cosmological evolution in the universe, you would end up today with an abundance, a calculable abundance of this particle that would match the measured value. And that's why people look for it, and rightfully so. So the new particles that I'm going to be motivating also have an affirmative answer to this question. They also have a good production mechanism that goes by the name of the misalignment mechanism. The last question that you ask, of course, okay, we know what our dark matter candidate is, we know how is it produced, does it have interactions with us other than gravitational? And luckily, in many theories, the answer is yes. It does have non-trivial interactions with us, interactions other than gravitational that we can design experiments for and look in the lab. But towards the end of the talk, though, I will also discuss what happens if the dark matter candidates that we look for only have gravitational couplings with us. Maybe there are ways to look for them even then. And this is the outline. So there are three classes of dark matter candidates that we'll be talking about, all motivated under the same thing. These are axions, which are spin zero particles, bosonic particles, that are parity odd, pseudoscalar. Dark photons, which are basically just like the photon, even though they are massive. And moduli, which are spin zero scalar particles. The difference between the moduli and the axions is the way their parity properties, so it's the way they interact with us. So starting from axions, perhaps the most famous axion of all is the QCD axion. The QCD axion was proposed as a solution to the strong CP problem in the standard model. So what is the strong CP problem? So in the standard model Lagrangian, there is no symmetry that forbids you from writing down a term that kind of looks like this. This is a simplification term. This is a simplified version of the term. It mixes the electric field of the strong interactions with the magnetic field of the strong interactions. So this is a CP odd term. Formally, for the theorists, this is the famous GG dual term. Okay? Its effects are parameterized, the strength of its effects. GS is the strength of the coupling of the strong interactions. Theta S is a parameter, it's an angle that tells you how parameterizes the strength of this term's effects on the particles. So we naively expected this parameter to be order one. And if it were order one, the neutron should have a large electric dipole moment that we should have seen decades ago. But we haven't. And the only thing that we've done so far through the famous EDM electric dipole moment experiments, all we've done so far is managed to constrain the parameter of this term to be less than 1 part in 10 to the 10. So the discrepancy between our expectations of the value of this term, which is order one, to what we measure it to be, is what we call the strong CP problem. And the axion solves this problem the following way. So people back in this has been a problem for a very long time. So people back in the late 70s, early 80s, Peche and Quing, Wilczek, Weinberg, postulated that this angle depends on x and t. It becomes a dynamical field, which they called the axion. So this field now, this particle, this new particle, its cosmological evolution forces the value of this theta parameter to dynamically go to zero as the universe evolves. And today, we expect, so that's why it relaxes to some very small value now. The axion gets its mass from non-perturbative QCD effects. And the size of the mass is determined by the axion decay constant, which is one parameter that determines all of the axion properties. So if that axion decay constant is close to the gut scale or the Planck scale, you find that the Compton wavelength of this particle is roughly 3 kilometers. So we're talking about an extremely light particle, much lighter than any of the matter fields that we have measured in the standard model. Now, and as I said, this is an excellent dark matter candidate and can also mediate new forces. Now, if you try to extend the standard model even beyond, go even further away, you will find in larger embeddings of the standard model, like string theory, you will find that the axion becomes very easy to get, becomes what we call generic. In fact, it may be that it comes with tens and hundreds brothers and sisters. Okay. So the reason that happens in string theory is because string theory has three main ingredients. It has extra dimensions that you need to make the theory mathematically consistent. It has gauge fields. It has particles that live in these extra dimensions. And it also has topology. Topology is just the shape that we compactify these extra dimensions to in order to give rise to our four-dimensional world. So you can compactify them on a sphere, you can compactify them on a torus, on something that looks like a pretzel, or even something much, much more complicated. This is a mathematical picture of a Calabi-Yau manifold. Now, the more complex these, the more complex, the more non-trivial topologically these compactifications are, the more particles you get. And also, the more, the different, for each different compactification, the theory that we get in our four dimensions varies. Okay? So the standard model in a theory where the extra dimensions are compactified as a sphere looks very different from the one where the extra dimensions are compactified in a Kabbalah-Biyao. You may not even have photons. You may not even have quarks. You have different forces. You have all sorts of... The mass of the Higgs is different. And each one of these compactifications that is corresponds to a different theory. And this is what people called the string landscape. This is what gave rise to something that, as I said, people hate a lot. But because they say, how do you make predictions in such a space? These theories are away from our causal contact. But nevertheless, this is a prediction of string theory. This is something that string theory doesn't seem to be able to avoid. And the interesting thing is that even though we may not be able to see these universes directly, we may be able to see the byproducts of the existence of these universes. So the fact that you have so much complexity gives rise to extra fields that are very light, that are bosonic, and can give signatures to experiments that we can do in the lab, and they can't be the dark matter. These fields appear as what we call non-trivial gauge field compactifications, okay? Non-trivial gauge field configurations, sorry, that carry no energy. And this is a lot of mathematical jargon, but just to give you some intuition, it's actually very easy to see where the intuition can come from, because everyone is familiar with a non-trivial gauge field configuration. And this happens in the Aharonov-Bohm experiment. So in the Aharonov-Bohm experiment, you have a solenoid threaded by a B field. If you take an electron around the solenoid in a region where the magnetic field is zero, there is still going to be a non-trivial phase shift on the electron, a physical effect, even though there is no force acting on the electron. Now, if you turn this by 90 degrees, so the electron has its nature, its motion gets affected even though it finds itself in a region where the B field is zero, but there is still energy that it took to produce this field configuration, and that's stored in the core of the solenoid in the form of the B field that it took to create this non-trivial flux through this area. This is where the case of string theory diverges a bit. So in the case of string theory, the space geometry, what it allows you to do is remove the region of space where you would have the energy needed to create this non-trivial gauge field configuration without destroying the non-trivial gauge field configuration itself. So you're left with something that's non-trivial while it carries no energy. So you're left with a massless, and in four dimensions, this corresponds to a massless particle. Now, of course, there is going to be small corrections to the mass of these particles that come from non-perturbative effects, symmetry breaking effects, but they're usually small because those particles also have the property that they interact very weakly with us. And the types of particles, there are three different types of particles this can give. So you can have spin zero, non-trivial gauge field configurations. These correspond to axions, which are behave very similar to the QCD axion that I mentioned before. There are spin one, non-trivial gauge field configurations. People refer to them as dark photons sometimes. These particles can kinetically mix with the ordinary photon, and they will have a mass. Finally, there are the fields that determine the shape and size of these extra dimensions. And as well as the value of the fundamental constants that we measure in the standard model. For example, the electron mass, the top U kappa, the fine structure constant. And these go by the name of the dilatons, the moduli, and the radian. All of these particles have the following characteristics. They couple to us very, very weakly. Sometimes the couplings, the extra couplings that you write down can be much, much weaker than those of gravity. They can be extremely light, and these two are closely connected. And through the years, we were already able to constrain them through their cosmology, through the effects in cosmology, for example, Big Bang nucleosynthesis, the cosmic microwave background, and other processes in stars. And when you go and open a review paper on axions, you will see all these grayed out areas. What happens if these particles are dark matter? So usually when you think of dark matter, the picture that comes to mind is little balls, little point particles bouncing around in the galaxy. And for things like a WIMP, this is pretty accurate. But quantum mechanics tells us that in reality, what you should be thinking about is a picture that more closely looks like this. You should be thinking about particles as having a finite, as little wave packets that have a size of order the de Broglie wavelength of the particle. Now, if the particle is heavy, and the number density of particles is low, these two pictures are completely equivalent. But as you start making the particle lighter and lighter, at some point, the waves start become overlapping. And then you no longer talk about particles anymore. It's better to talk about a wave, scalar wave. And this is only true for bosons. For fermions, you know that Pauli's exclusion principle does not let you have these wave packets overlap. And in fact, just from Pauli's exclusion principle, there is a lower bound on the fermionic dark matter mass, which is around 70 eV. For a bosonic, as I said, there is no roadblock. The bosonic dark matter candidates can be as light as possible, all the way down to 10 to the minus 22 eV. At some point, the wave packets don't fit into galaxies anymore. So this way, as I said, this happens when the local dark matter number density of dark matter particles becomes larger than one particle per de Broglie wavelength. In our neighborhood, this means this picture, this transition happens when for dark matter a candidate is lighter than 1 eV. At that point, you just write, take your dark matter, and you write it as a wave, as a field, that oscillating with an amplitude phi naught, which is proportional to the square root of the dark matter density and inversely proportional to the dark matter mass, and a frequency omega, which is essentially the total energy, mass plus kinetic energy, of dark matter in the galaxy. Because dark matter is virialized and very non-relativistic, this frequency is just set by the mass of the dark matter. But also because the dark matter is virialized, there is a finite coherence of this oscillation set by the virial velocity squared. So this oscillation is only coherent for 10 to the 6 periods. As I said before, these dark matter candidates have an excellent production mechanism. And this is active, this misalignment mechanism, you can think about it as being active during the inflationary period of the universe, which happened much, much before the WIMP production. WIMPs were produced much, much later compared to these particles in the evolution of the universe. So how does the misalignment mechanism work? So for this field, if you write down the cosmological equation for its the cosmological evolution equation, you will find that it actually looks very similar to that for a harmonic oscillator, simple harmonic oscillator. The resonant frequency of the oscillator is set by the mass, and there is a friction term set by the Hubble rate, the rate at which the universe expands. So in the early universe, Hubble was high, the universe was very hot, or even during inflation, there was a lot of energy density, so Hubble again was high. Then, and it was much larger than the mass. So this harmonic oscillator was overdamped in the early universe. So if you are away from the minimum, then you are stuck. The amplitude of this oscillation does not decay. And you expect to be away from the minimum because inflation, quantum fluctuations during inflation, cause you to do a random walk around this potential. Now, as the universe cools, eventually the Hubble rate becomes less than the mass. And then you go from an overdamped to an underdamped regime, and the oscillator starts what it's supposed to, oscillate. Then you find the remarkable thing that the energy density stored in this oscillator field scales exactly, behaves exactly like cold dark matter is supposed to behave. You find that the energy density gets diluted like the scale factor to the third power. And today, so the amplitude dies off with the cosmological evolution, and today, if you compare this amplitude of the oscillation to the Planck scale, you find that it's a very small number. You find that it's 1 part in 10 to the 13. For a particle that oscillates with that has a mass of 10 to the minus 18 eV, or an oscillation frequency of roughly a period of 1,000 seconds. This is also a Compton wavelength of the Earth-Sun distance, just to give you some idea. And of course, it's inversely proportional to the mass of the particle. Now, this is just a little parenthesis. For these very light dark matter candidates, it's important to pay close attention to measurements of tensor modes coming from inflation, of gravitational waves at the CMB. The reason is, when during inflation, just like the inflaton, this phi field will also fluctuate quantum mechanically. So this phi field, this new bosonic dark matter candidate, carries its own density fluctuations that have a completely different shape than those that the inflaton produces. Okay? So if those perturbations, the so-called isocurvature perturbations, were to dominate, you would be measuring something else at the CMB. You would be measuring something different. How big they are depends on the Hubble scale during inflation. So if we were to somehow measure the Hubble scale during inflation, we would know how big those fluctuations for these fields are. And turns out, if it is too high, like the BICEP measurement was implying a couple of years ago, a large part of the parameter space for these particles would be greatly disfavored or even excluded. So a measurement of gravitational waves from the CMB is in many cases in conflict with these type of dark matter candidates. And vice versa. If you were to discover that the dark matter is one of these guys, it may tell you that you probably wouldn't be able to observe ever gravitational waves coming from inflation. So keep an eye out, okay? So when the BICEP measurement came out, it was a big hit on this type of dark matter candidates. Of course, the measurement wasn't correct, so back to the old story. So now I'll tell you a bit about how these things couple. I told you how they are produced. So we'll start again from the axions. And many of you, now, if you're not familiar with this experiment, you should be. The ADMX experiment is the first experiment to be able to probe in the laboratory parameter space of the QCD axion that is not excluded from astrophysics. So a significant step to our searches for this type of particle. That's why I think it's very important, and it's taking data right now. So the way these experiments work, they take advantage of the axion coupling to photons. So in the presence of a magnetic field, axions get converted to photons. If the magnetic field is applied in a cavity, what happens is the energy from the axion is transferred to a certain cavity mode. And then you can use fancy sensors that we'll hear about this week to pick the signal up. This is a resonant search, and where the rate of conversion is enhanced when the cavity size becomes the same much as the axion size. And of course, there are other experiments that take up on this coupling and expand this idea, like LC circuits or searches that we heard from Rydberg atoms. There are even ideas like that. The other thing that axions do is they couple to nuclei. And in spins in general. For nuclei, they can have both a scalar coupling, a monopole coupling, but they can also a dipole coupling, coupling directly to the spin of the nucleon. So if you were to take a mass with n nucleons next to a spin, and a fundamental spin, or a mass that contains n polarized spins next to a spin, there's going to be some interaction energy. That means there's going to be a force between them. Okay? So axions mediate new forces that are monopole-dipole or dipole-dipole kind. You can also use the coupling of the spin to axions to look for dark matter, because if spins that move through the dark matter wind will feel the axion kind of like a precessing magnetic field, like an oscillating magnetic field that will affect the dynamics. And there are some talks on this this week. Now for dark photons. Perhaps this, I only have one slide on this because I think it's the most easy to understand. They kinetically mix with a photon, and they behave just like the photon. Okay? The only difference with a photon is that they are massive. So the dispersion relation is different. And because they have a mass, they can also be the dark matter. Now, just to give you some idea, and then you can detect it the same way you would detect an ordinary photon. For example, in the axion experiment, if you turn off the magnetic field in the cavity, you could have resonant conversions of dark photons into ordinary photons inside the cavity, and you would excite the cavity. So the ADMX experiment can also look for these guys. Just to give you some idea, an interesting, cute fact, there is a lot of energy stored in the dark matter field. If you were to calculate the electric field corresponding to dark photons, if they were dark matter, you would find that it's 50 volts per centimeter, roughly the voltage difference across a plug in North America, okay? This is a good mnemonic. It's a lot of power, right? The problem is, though, that we couple to it very, very weakly, so we cannot take advantage of it. There is a lot of energy stored in dark matter, but because we couple to it so weakly, we cannot take advantage of it. Still, it's a remarkable coincidence that it's this big. So finally, I will talk about the moduli, okay? And I will spend a bit more time on these because these are not things that people are familiar with. Axions had been around for much longer than most. Then came dark photons. And the latest entry in the book is moduli. So, as I said, these are scalar particles, spin zero particles. So they have non-derivative couplings to standard model fields. What does this mean? Well, it means that the Lagrangian of these particles can be written as this. Phi is the particle over a scale lambda times any of the operators of the standard model. It can be the electron mass, the quark masses, the strength of the field strength of the strong interactions or the electromagnetic interactions. So what this operator is depends on these properties of this field phi. If, for example, you're talking about the modulus that determines the electron mass, the electron you cover, then that field will couple to this operator, okay, to the electron mass operator. So if this particle is dark matter, I said the good way to describe it is by assuming that, by thinking about it as an oscillating wave. So if you have a wave that's oscillating, coupling to what you think is a fundamental constant, then that constant is no longer a constant. So the oscillation from the dark matter is communicated to the standard model particle values, to the standard model parameters. So, for example, my favorite is the electron because it's the easiest to understand. If it is the electron and it couples with this operator here, let's say that I normalize the strength of the interaction to the Planck scale, you will see that locally the electron mass will fluctuate by an amount that's proportional to the amplitude of the dark matter and the strength of the interaction. So for something that couples with gravitational strength, you will find that this local oscillation is roughly 1 part in 10 to the 12. And this is for something that has a period of oscillation of 1,000 seconds. This amplitude goes down as the frequency goes up. And of course, it's proportional to the coupling strength. Okay. So this is a very, very small value, right? It won't cause any catastrophes for us. We won't blow up because we start vibrating too much. But it tells you that you need a very sensitive, this is why you need to do precision experiments to probe these things. In many ways, we have been already looking for this type of particles, this type of dark matter candidate. Similar to the axion, they can mediate new forces in matter. These forces appear as long-range modifications of gravity. The other thing that they do is they also mediate equivalence principle violating forces. So for example, if you have a very light particle, this very light boson that couples to the electron mass, then the force between two objects depends on how many electrons they have, how much of their energy rest mass is in electrons. So things that have different consistencies will interact with a different force. So you expect these particles to violate the weak equivalence principle, sometimes that can be avoided, but certainly the strong equivalence principle. And you can use, in fact, there are proposals to use this coupling to look for an equivalence violating force coming from the dark matter wind using accelerometers. So these properties can also be used to look for dark matter. So how do you look for oscillating fundamental constants? The first thing you use is atomic clocks, because atomic clocks use their ticking rate of atomic clocks is set by the sizes of the fundamental constant, the electron mass, the fine structure constant, the proton mass. So if any of those variables oscillate, you would produce a variation, an oscillation at the ticking rate of atomic clocks. The other thing you can do is look for variations of sizes. So, and this is true for my favorite example of the electron mass modulus. So if you have something that couples to the electron mass and makes it oscillate, it means that the Bohr radius changes size. So if the Bohr radius changes size, you know that the object, the sizes of objects will change. And that is by, if you have something that resonates with the frequency of that vibration, then you can excite a big motion in the object. If you look at the papers, you'll see, in fact, that there is a constraint on this type of dark matter coming from the Earth itself, because the Earth itself can be excited by this type of dark matter. And there is a constraint on this type of dark matter that's better than any experiments that we have done in the lab, just by looking at the vibrations of the Earth. So finally, so I told you about general characteristics about how axions, moduli, and dark photons couple. So, but what happens, these are, of course, all model dependent. The string theory doesn't tell you the values of these couplings. The only particle that we have an idea of how it couples is the QCD axion. That's why it's the first one that we advertise, always. It has a very well-defined parameter space, and for experimentalists, it's a golden carrot, okay? Something you can go out trying to find, and if you don't find it, it's meaningful, because you know that if you exclude that parameter space, you know that for sure it's not there. For the other particles, the couplings are unknowns. There can be, you do searches, you exclude some part of the parameter space, but the couplings could be even smaller or may not even be there at all. So what happens in the extreme case where these particles don't couple to us at all, other than the force of gravity? Is there a way to look for them in that case? And yes, there is, at least for some part of the parameter space. And the way you do this is through black holes. Astrophysical black holes have a characteristic size due to their mass, the size of the horizon. And that varies between 1 kilometer and 10 to the 10 kilometers. So turns out there's an effect called superaddience that makes black holes sensitive to the presence in the theory of bosons that have a similar size. This is particularly exciting now because we have seen gravitational waves, we have seen black holes, and we have seen their signatures. In fact, since 2 years ago now, we have been offered a new type of probe for the universe. We have advanced LIGO, the discovery of advanced LIGO inaugurated the epoch of gravitational wave astronomy. So actually some of these ideas that we'll hear about today are how do you expand, open the eyes beyond the narrow band of LIGO to try, in our efforts to try to see the universe. This is a plot that shows, as a function of frequency, different sources and different proposed experiments. Of course, every time, and we have some idea, this mostly comes from gravitational wave mergers. As I will discuss, there are signatures that can come from beyond the standard model physics. But of course, the most important thing to keep in mind, every time we're inventing something, a new telescope, we're finding something about the cosmos that we didn't know was there before. So the element of surprise here can be quite important. So how do you look for beyond the standard model physics signatures in gravitational waves? One way is this effect of superaddience. And in order to explain it to you, I'll show you a little cartoon. Superaddience is an effect that has nothing to do with gravity exclusively. It in fact appears in many systems, in any system that has dissipation. For example, Cherenkov radiation is a version of superaddience. So how does it work? So imagine you have a little particle ball and a rotating cylinder. And the surface of the cylinder is very rough. So now you shoot the ball towards the cylinder. If the cylinder is moving more slowly than the ball, then at the point of contact they meet like this, and the ball comes out with lower velocity than what it came in. Okay, so you, the cylinder takes away energy from the ball. Now let's speed up the cylinder even more. At some point, the velocities of the ball and the cylinder match, and there is no energy loss, okay? Independently of whether we have friction or not. Now let's speed the cylinder even more. Now the cylinder is moving faster than the ball at the point of contact. Then what will happen is the cylinder will grab onto the ball and give it a big kick. So the ball will come out with much higher energy than what it came in. So this is like a process that that gives out energy when you were expecting exactly the opposite, when you had dissipation, where you had friction. So a similar thing happens for waves. I'm talking about a ball here, but a similar thing happens for waves. So imagine now turn my friction-full cylinder into a conducting cylinder. For photons, finite conductivity or finite resistivity is friction, it's loss. So if I take an electromagnetic wave, I scatter it from a rotating conducting cylinder, if the angular velocity of the cylinder is faster than the angular velocity of the wave, I will see that the wave comes out with higher amplitude than what it came in. So this is for Zeldovich and Bekenstein. This is what the process that they usually refer to when they talk about black hole superradiance. So for black holes, we know astrophysical black holes are rotating, okay? And if you look at them from the top, they look like this. There's the black hole in the center with the horizon, and outside of it, there is a region called the Ergo region where even light has to rotate. This is the region that signals to the world that the black hole is moving. So if you take an electromagnetic wave, a gravitational wave, and you scatter it from the black hole, it can come out with higher amplitude than what it came in. And this is a process that extracts energy and angular momentum from the black hole. Back in 72, President Tucholsky wrote a cute paper that said, well, let's surround the black hole with a perfectly spherical mirror and repeat the same experiment. So now what happens is the amplitude gets, there is subsequent reflection, so the growth of the amplitude becomes exponential, and eventually the amplitude becomes so large that radiation pressure makes the mirror explode. Okay? And they call this the black hole bomb. Of course, this is not something that we can realistically build around black holes because we cannot send people there to build perfectly spherical mirrors. And they did it, I should say, this was an experiment done with a thought experiment done with photons. So if now photons are massless bosons, if the boson now has a mass, then what happens is that the mass will cause the boson to have a bound state with a black hole. So for a rotating black hole now, what will happen is the particle is confined to be to the vicinity of the black hole, and its mass acts like a mirror, like the perfectly spherical mirror we saw before. So what will happen in astrophysical black hole, you will see this black hole spinning down and a cloud of particles forming in a bound orbit around the black hole. This process is most efficient when the black hole size is comparable to the particle Compton wavelength. So how does it look? Turns out this gravitational atom looks very similar to a hydrogen atom. Okay, so you can define a fine structure constant for it, which is just the gravitational coupling strength, g newton, times the mass of the black hole times the mass of the particle. You find that there is binding energy that matches very, very much the Rydberg formula. So you can describe for a spin zero particle all the states with three quantum numbers that they usually describe hydrogen wave functions. But there are big differences, okay? First of all, for a hydrogen wave function, the bound states are occupied by fermions, so you can only have two. Here, the bound states are occupied by photons, by bosons, sorry. So these, the occupation number can be 10 to the 77 or larger. So the growth of this process is similar to a lasing effect, okay? The other thing that's different is the ingoing boundary condition at the horizon. So if you look at the hydrogen wave function, when you solve for it, you have to make it regular at the origin, right? But for a black hole, there is no origin, there is just the horizon. So you impose an ingoing boundary condition at the horizon. So when you solve for the eigenvalues, for the energies of these states, you find that they are not strictly real. They have a small imaginary part. Sometimes, most of the times, the imaginary part is negative, so they decay, they fall back into the black hole. Sometimes it's positive, so they grow. So this is how you see the exponential stability arise. So as I said, this is a kinematic condition, and it happens when the energy of the particle, the total energy of the particle in the bound orbit is less than the magnetic quantum number times the angular velocity of the black hole. This is exactly the same condition that I showed before with the rotating cylinders. Of course, the next question is how fast does it happen? For astrophysical black holes, the dynamical evolution time scale is the accretion time scale, which is 10 to the 8 years. Superaddians for stellar mass black holes can happen as fast as 100 seconds. So for objects that we have seen, and we know they're there in the universe, this process has enough time, if the particle is there, to affect its dynamics. Okay? And there are several signatures of this black hole with a gazillion particles rotating around it in a bound orbit. Turns out that in the cloud, if you have a scalar particle, two particles from the cloud can annihilate to a single graviton, whose energy is roughly twice the particle mass. This process produces very monochromatic, very coherent radiation that advanced LIGO can look for. So this particle annihilation in the cloud, even though if you had the two particles doing it in empty space, because it's gravitational annihilation, it's a tiny, tiny coupling, it's a tiny rate. These are processes that are enhanced by the huge occupation. These are Bose-enhanced processes. So that's why you get huge rates that can be observable at advanced LIGO. And this is a plot that tries to quantify what are the prospects of advanced LIGO seeing this. So here you see, as a function of the axion mass, how many of these gravitational wave sources you would expect to see. And of course, there is a band, because as in astrophysics, you have to make pessimistic, realistic, and optimistic. You have to make some assumptions because you're producing rates, event rates, that are very sensitive to the black hole mass distribution, the black hole spin distribution, how many black holes you have in the universe, which we know very little about. Okay, so you see that the main point is that for a large part of this plot, there is you lies above one for a large range of masses. Okay. Which makes this an exciting probability for advanced LIGO.
But it's one per year?
No, this is not. This is expected number of sources. So you turn on the experiment, you do a blind search, how many gravitational wave beacons you see. This is not a source that transient effect. This is a very monochromatic thing that just lies. In order to talk about rates, you have to let the experiment run for more than the time that it takes for black holes to be born in our vicinity. So you have to wait for more than 30 years to start talking about rates in this plot, okay? But you could look for such things in mergers, merger events, reset the clock, right? So that's another way to talk about events. But in this case, this is a blind search looking for old remnants that have this cloud around them. And as I said, this is just one example, right, of the possibility. I talked about LIGO, so I focused on this, on this part of the frequency, but superaddians can be active for even supermassive black holes and can be applicable to a wide variety of gravitational wave detectors. Some of them have been proposed, some of them are under construction. This just gives you an idea of the things that we can think about probing in the laboratory, from gravitational wave detectors, from dark matter searches. There is a lot of, there is a lot of room, both in the theoretical side and both in the experimental side, to cover this whole parameter space. Thank you. Questions? Okay, good.
That was a totally fantastic talk.
Thank you.
Really inspirational. Have LIGO already looked with the very tiny number of black hole mergers they've already seen?
Yeah.
Three or so.
Yeah.
They've already set limits to all kinds of new physics.
Yes.
With that very limited data set, have they already at least attempted something that shows some sort of deviation would be consistent with
so in those events, turns out you wouldn't see necessarily the effects of superaddians, because by the time the black holes merge, the clouds are gone. They are tidally disrupted as the things go close. So by the time they merge, you wouldn't see the clouds. But what you can do is use their spin measurements as statistics, because from the event they can. Yes, that's my. I'm out of time. Yes. So you would measure the spins of the black holes in the merger,
yeah.
And those would give you. Then you can do statistically. So if you see many black holes that are slowly rotating around a certain mass range, then it would signify the presence of such particles. But not directly from the merger, the fact that they saw the merger, from the waveform of the merger. It won't show you things like that. Okay.
Yes? You said a bit more at the very beginning of your talk, you mentioned that the astrophysical primordial black holes theory of dark matter is excluded because their formation processes are not.
I didn't say. No, it's not excluded completely. I mean, John can tell you, he's thought about it more. The problem is, I'll tell you the problem with. Let me tell you what I think about primordial, and then John can tell you the details of primordial black holes. We observe density perturbations from the CMB at relatively large scales that are a level of 10 to the minus 5. Okay? Now, in order for you to be able to produce primordial black holes, you have to create some situation in the early universe where density perturbations were order one. So if you try to write down models for that, it is very, very hard to do. Okay? It doesn't want to come out naturally. Here, in comparison, these fields are just junk that could be left over from the quantum kicking around during inflation. Which is purely gravitational, by the way. So these fields, in fact, if they are there in the theory, it's very hard to not have a certain component of dark matter coming from them. This depends on their mass, but they will always be there because it's purely gravitational. Like quantum kicks during inflation will produce them for sure, and those quantum kicks will behave like dark matter. For primordial black holes, it's just that the production mechanisms are much, much harder.
Harder, but not
also. Does the calculable ways of producing primordial black holes turn out to be exponentially sensitive to unknown parameters? Right? Therefore, it would be remarkable if you're anywhere near the appropriate bands, right?
Yeah.
We can't have vastly more than the dark matter density. We must be sort of, you know, 1% or less, probably. You know, there are possible other mechanisms but they involve intrinsically strong gravitational field dynamics, and no one has done the right sort of calculations. You know, it's not totally impossible that, you know, using Pretorius's...
it's not impossible. It's just very hard to...
Yes.
There is a thing also, there are limits of a wide range of parameter space for the primordial black hole mass. You've got to be careful about interpreting those things because they assume that they're basically the primordial black holes are a delta function distributed, right? Meaning, you know, it's all at a certain mass. If there was a mechanism to produce broad distributions of primordial black hole mass, those limits you see would not be quite as, you know, a weaker. Right? So it depends very much what you think the production mechanism is. But at least if it's delta function distributed, then they can only be in certain rather than very narrow ranges.
Yes. Yeah.
Oh, just a comment that there is actually a large open parameter space at for primordial black holes at the lower masses, and actually there have been some more recent mechanisms proposed that are more plausible than the older ones. So just a comment regarding what some people think is natural or not natural for mechanisms. So.
No, but the statement is, let me tell you, there's a general thing. Many things are possible. If you think about all the dark matter models that people have come up with, many things are possible. The question is, where do you start looking from, right? You start looking from the things that are easiest to produce,
sure.
Right? And that's why the WIMP got such a big boost. That was very, very correct way to go after it, because it has a very concrete parameter space. You know how it couples to us. You know what strength it couples to us, so it is a very good thing to go after. So this is what I'm advocating for. So you go first, look after for the things that are easiest to do, and then you start. Okay, if you exclude the most, what you think are the most likely, then you go to try thinking about things that are logically possible, albeit contrived.
Mina, do you have any comment on, you did spin 0 and spin 1?
Yes, spin 2?
Yeah.
Yeah, we've thought about it. It is a possibility in theories of extra dimensions that they are there.
Yes.
We just haven't found a good way to look for them.
No, that's a good question.
I should have put a slide. Spin 2. Yeah, and usually for those, because of the bounds on extra dimensions, the natural scale is a bit heavier than what I presented. They have to be heavier than a milli EV or so. But sure, in principle, someone could look for them. Maybe indirectly by looking for modifications of Newton's law at short distances is a better way. And then you start seeing, okay, can I ask the question if they are dark matter or not? But certainly they... I don't know how would they produce them cold, though. See, this is the thing that we couldn't find. Yeah, I don't know how to produce very cold spin 2 particles.
Can you imagine doing it in Randall's under?
I don't know if you can do it to
sun. You have very light spin 2 resonance.
Yeah, but can they be produced very cosmologically? Can they be produced with like cold dark matter, like the misalignment doesn't work for this. But in principle, yes. But and we did think about how to see it, but nothing that would give us an observable scene. Yes, you have a question?
I was just wondering, is there any like lab demonstration of the super radiance?
Good. Yes, I think there are some electromagnetic experiments that have been done.
There are many experiments. Is there a super radiance of photons?
No, not laser super radiance. I'm not talking about like Dicke type super radiance.
Right.
It's not the same as this type super radiance. Yes. So are you talking about Dicke super radiance? Yes, exactly. See, yeah, because they use the same name, but they're completely different.
Yes.
Okay.
So there is something that's directly analogous to this.
Yes. So I think people have done experiments with rotating cylinders, I think. And there is people that have done with whirlpools. So if you take a big pot of water, drill a hole in the bottom, so you have a vortex, and now you take surface waves and you scatter them from that vortex that forms from the drain. Of course, the problem with these experiments usually is that there are losses. So you never see, so when the waves scatter from the wall, the loss factor is so large that you never see the exponential growth. What you see is the thing decaying slow, more slowly than you might expect it to decay. And the measurements are not good. But there are efforts to do that. And the Whirlpool thing is pretty neat. Yeah, so that's it. Thank you, everyone. So, happy time. Oh.